Well, it's certainly a blessing to be back again once again tonight. Hope everyone has had a good day and thankful that God has blessed us with the ability, the health, and the strength to be out tonight to worship Him, study His Word. Got some very good friends in the audience. Won't mention all of them, but thankful from wherever you're coming from if you're visiting tonight. I know that you're a big encouragement to the church here. And if we have local visitors, we really appreciate you making the effort to come out tonight. We're going to continue in our study of the book of Daniel from chapter 5. So if you haven't already turned there, turn to Daniel chapter 5. For a long time, liberal critics of the Bible maintained that this chapter didn't actually take place, that Belshazzar was not a historical figure. There was no archaeological evidence or proof that he existed. But as we'll look at in just a moment, the archaeologists have proven the critics of the Bible, again, wrong. So what we're looking at here is a firsthand eyewitness account of a major historical event in human history. Even if you don't believe in the Bible, you know that the end of the Babylonian Empire and what happened on this very night was significant. And so this is a really unique opportunity we have to read from Daniel, who was there on the night that Babylon fell, and have an eyewitness account of it. And of course, there's some great lessons here for us. We've talked some about how kingdoms rise and they fall, and if the Lord allows the earth to remain, this nation will fall just like Babylon fell. But I don't want us to think only in terms of geopolitics. We need to think very personally about our lives, because there are some specific applications we need to make. And think about how we all stand before God in the same way that Belshazzar stood so long ago. And we need to make application to our own lives. And so let's think about that as we read together from Daniel chapter 5. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand, and the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed, and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." And all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation." Then Daniel was brought in before the king, and the king answered and said to Daniel, "You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king my father brought from Judah. I have heard of you that the Spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation. But they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve riddles. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself, and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know. But the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways, you have not honored. Then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed, and this is the writing that was inscribed, Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parson. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple. A chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So who was this king, Belshazzar, that critics of the Bible said did not exist? Archaeologists have found a cylinder called the Nabonidus cylinder. You can find it in the British Museum today, that shows Belshazzar's name, proving that he did exist, corroborating what we read here in Daniel chapter 5. Well, who was this Belshazzar? Well, we are 70 years, you understand, from Daniel chapter 1. So we're no longer dealing with a young Daniel. Daniel may have been a teenager, a young teenager at that. Now he's an old man. And we're 23 years from what we read about in chapter 4, when Nebuchadnezzar was judged and made to eat grass. In 562 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar died. He had reigned for 43 years, and the empire really declined after his death. You might say that the zenith, or one of the high points of the Babylonian Empire, was during Nebuchadnezzar's reign. His son, Amel-Marduk, reigned for only 2 years. He's known in the Bible as Evil-Merodach, listed in 2 Kings 25 and Jeremiah 52. He was the one who released Jehoiachin from prison and gave him a place in the Babylonian court. Amel-Marduk was assassinated by his brother-in-law. He was replaced by Nergal-Sharezer, who reigned for 4 years, and then he died and was succeeded by his son, who was only 9 months old, Labishai-Marduk. He was beaten to death by conspirators. And actually all of the children from Nebuchadnezzar's family were wiped out. And so there was no heir to the throne. And a conspirator appointed Nabonidus as the king. And this was the king that everyone recognized. At least the liberal critics of the Bible said, well, Belshazzar was not the king when Babylon fell. It was Nabonidus. And indeed, Nabonidus was king when Babylon fell. But he was a co-regent with his son, Belshazzar. Nabonidus was defeated by Cyrus, of course, the Persian king. Of course, he was not from Nebuchadnezzar's family. He had no right to the royal line. So what he did is he married either the widow or of Nebuchadnezzar or one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters to gain some kind of legitimacy for his throne. And his son, Belshazzar, was appointed as co-regent with him. Because of the fragile nature of the kingdom and because the Medes and the Persians were growing in power, Nabonidus moved the capital from Babylon way out in the desert. And for 17 years he reigned there in a place called Taima, T-A-Y-M-A, out in Arabia. But Belshazzar remained in Babylon, in the city of Babylon, and he reigned there for 14 of those 17 years, along with his father as co-regent. And by the way, that's why Daniel was not offered second in command over Babylon, but third, because there were two who would be naturally ahead of him. There were co-regents at that time. Well, Cyrus was taking over the world, and of course, Babylon stood in his way, and so he met Nabonidus and his army outside of Babylon, about 50 miles south of Babylon. He was defeated. He took him captive, and he was exiled in Carmenia until he died. And so the Medes and the Persians, after defeating Nabonidus and many of the armies, then surrounded the city of Babylon. And that is the setting of Daniel chapter 5. The kingdom is just hanging by a thread. You can imagine that at this time, the city being besieged as it was, that there were people who were going without food. And so you may wonder, well, why would the king in the middle of this, terrible tragedy going on in the empire and so many people probably starving at this time, why would he throw such a lavish feast, not just for a few people, but a great feast for 1,000 of his lords? Why would he do something like this? That would seem to be foolish. Well, I think this was strategically done. And this kind of feast, by the way, was not uncommon in ancient times. We read about Alexander the Great one time holding a marriage feast and serving 10,000. At this, you would imagine how much food and wine would be required. And when they would throw a feast like this, it wouldn't just be for one evening. It would go on for days and weeks at a time. And so why would he throw such a lavish, expensive, extravagant feast during a time of war and famine? Well, I think it was to show to the lords that everything's okay. We've got plenty of food. We're going to ride this thing out. We're weak. We're not weak. We're strong. And in fact, we're going to show our strength by serving all of this food. And what he does in a very symbolic way is he calls for these vessels to be taken, brought in that had been taken out of the temple in Jerusalem. Again, we mentioned in chapter 1, these golden vessels were not melted down and used for other purposes. They were kept really as trophies, as symbols of the strength and the might of the Babylonian armies and the superiority of their gods over the gods that they defeated. And so it's a way of saying, look, our gods have protected us in the past. Our gods are going to protect us now. They defeated Israel. They defeated Israel's God. And so our gods will save us now. There's nothing to be worried about. We've got these We've got these huge walls. We talked about how massive the city of Babylon was in ancient times. The walls would archaeologists assume that they were probably around 11 miles in circumference. They were double walls. The outer wall 25 feet thick. The inner wall 23 feet thick. I mean, everything's going to be okay. We don't have to worry about the Medes and the Persians outside. Our gods, our walls, our army, they're going to protect us. We're going to be okay. But what really stands out to us is what they were doing. They were blaspheming God. And that's the problem here. That's the crux of the matter in Daniel chapter 5. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. And for that reason, Belshazzar had to be judged. And so we come to the handwriting on the wall. It says in verse 5 that immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall. Archaeologists have found a palace in Babylon that is a very large room, 55 feet wide and 169 feet long, and the walls are plastered. And it could very well be that this is the room where Belshazzar first saw the handwriting on the wall. And as one commentator I read said, he went from beating his chest to knocking his knees. It says that his color changed. You can just see the color of his face going white as a sheet. Terrified by what he's seeing. Not afraid of the human enemies outside the walls, and yet scared to death of this supernatural enemy that's within the walls. That's what he needed to understand. Is that the one whom he must give account to is not repelled by walls. The one in whose hand was his very breath was right there in that room. And he was going to have to give an account to that supernatural judge. The king's wise men came in, and the same commentator described these as the clown parade all coming in. They come in chapter 2, they come in chapter 4, they come in chapter 5, and they give no answers. In chapter 5, they can't even read what's written on the wall, and what is on the wall is Aramaic. But they can't read it. And I believe it was just God's way of showing how impotent these men are. They offer no answers. And it's not hard to figure out what, I mean, if you know what these words mean, it's not hard to figure out what the interpretation is. It's pretty self-explanatory. But they can't even read it. That's how helpless they were. And so all the wise men came in and they offered no help at all. But the queen, and this is probably the queen mother, and maybe not even the mother, it may have been the grandmother, if this was Nebuchadnezzar's wife. She comes in and she says, well, there is a man. We've forgotten about Daniel. You remember Daniel was the chief of the wise men, appointed to that position by Nebuchadnezzar. And yet, no one's been consulting Daniel lately, have they? No one's been going to him, asking him questions about what should be done in the empire. But now that all the resources have been exhausted, and now that all the wise men have been shown once again to be the frauds that they are, now we're going to go and ask Daniel, well, what is this handwriting on the wall? What does it say? What does it mean? And so Daniel is brought in. And what does Daniel have to say? Well, you notice that Daniel's attitude is different in chapter 5 than it was in chapter 4. He was very sympathetic to Nebuchadnezzar. But he doesn't come in and say, long live the king. Of course, it would have been futile to say that because the king is going to live much longer. And Daniel knows that. And he doesn't say, oh, I wish that this was speaking of your enemies. Daniel doesn't seem to appreciate this king, the way he appreciated Nebuchadnezzar. And when the king offers him, you know, you'll be third in command and great honors and all of this royal garments and gold and jewelry will be given to you, he says, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Those things won't matter at all tomorrow because I know what's about to happen tonight. And you may wonder, why is he being so harsh with Belshazzar? Why is his attitude different? Well, I think the answer is found in what he says to him later. He says, your father, Nebuchadnezzar, and of course this is his grandfather he's speaking of. He says, your father, he was brought to his knees many years ago. And he was like you at one time, feeling like he was above everyone else, feeling like he was self-sufficient and in control. And God had to make him come to understand that there is a God who rules in heaven, who raises up kings and brings down kings. And God humbled him and he yielded allegiance to this God and praised him and even sent out an edict to all the kingdom that people should worship him. And yet, though you knew all of this, you've not responded yourself. And that's the problem. He knew better. And he did nothing about it. And so, his days are up. He says, you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven, and now you're going to face the God who is in control. You have praised the gods of silver, gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath. I appreciated Tim acknowledging that in his prayer tonight. I've tried to think about that every morning when I pray to God. I think about the fact that the very reason I got up out of bed and the reason I could take my first breath is because God gives me that breath. We cannot do anything without God. And we need to remember that. He says, God in whose hand is your breath and whose are all your ways. Listen, if you are successful in life, it's because God has given you that success. Do not think for a moment that you have made this life for yourself. You can't even breathe without God, let alone go to work at that job that you have, let alone raise your family or raise your grandkids or do whatever you do in the community or at school. Everything that you have comes from God. And that's what Belshazzar needed to understand, is that he was helpless and hopeless without God. Those walls weren't going to protect him from the living God. The gods of wood and iron and stone and gold, they weren't going to protect him from the living God. He was using the vessels from the house of God to worship these lifeless idols and not honoring the one in whose hand was his breath. And so he gives him the interpretation, the reading and the interpretation. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Your days are up. This is it. There's no more chances. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. The way you determined the value of something in ancient times was by how much it weighed. You would put the standard on one end of the scales and you'd put the grain or whatever else you're weighing on the other, and that's how you determine how much it was worth. And he says, you've been put in the balance of the scales and it's dropping to the floor. You're weightless. Your righteousness is nothing. You've been found wanting. And so the verdict was Perez, meaning divided. Your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and to the Persians. And Herodotus tells us that on the 16th day of Tishri, 539 B.C., which would be the 11th or 12th of October, the Persians built a dam. The river Euphrates flowed through the city. That was one of the ways that they could withstand a long siege. They had a constant water supply coming through their city. And so what they did is they dammed up that river. And much of the water flowed out into a swampy area. And now those walls had a big hole in them. The soldiers were able to go underneath the wall. The water only came up to their knees or maybe their waist. And when they got behind those walls, they opened up the walls and the army just marched right in. And it was like shooting fish in a barrel. The enemy was right there and you couldn't go anywhere. They were trapped by the walls. And so Babylon fell in one night. And yes, Belshazzar died, as Daniel chapter 5 tells us, that very night. But again, this is not about Belshazzar. It's not about Babylon. It's not even about the United States of America or any other world power today. This is about you and me. This chapter has been preserved so that we might learn the lesson that we need to learn. And so we need to learn three things. First of all, we need to recognize what the idols are in our lives. No, we may not worship idols made of gold and silver and stone, but we are no less worshipers of idols. Our idols come in different forms. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5 says that covetousness is idolatry. We can worship our money, we can worship our possessions, our hobbies, our careers. We can even worship what we see in the mirror and our appearance. We can worship our status, our children. There's any number of things that we can put before God and derive our sense of worth and our sense of identity from those things. Those are the things that we will be judged for in the last day. And so we need to recognize what those idols are so that we might put them away in our life. And we need to respond to what we know that is true. James chapter 1 talks about the Word of God being like a mirror. Like a man looking at his natural face in the mirror and then turning away and forgetting what he looked like. We can't do that. We've got to be doers of the Word and not hearers only. We can't walk away from this. We can't hear the story of Belshazzar and do the same thing Belshazzar did. He knew about the story of his father Nebuchadnezzar. He had heard all of that before, but he turned away from the mirror. He maybe could see himself in his father, but he turned away from it and forgot it. We can walk away from Daniel chapter 5 tonight. We can look at the idolatry in our heart and just turn away and not do anything about it. And we will be judged. We will be judged. And we will be given greater judgment because to the one who has more, more will be expected of him. So we need to be careful that we respond to what we know that is true. If you know that you're not living right before God tonight, don't walk away tonight without making the changes that you need to make. And we need to repent while there is yet time. Jesus told a story about another man who faced judgment in a single night. In Luke chapter 12 and verse 13, someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully, and he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'" And so you say, "Well, preacher, you're just trying to scare us." Well, yes, I am. These are the words of Jesus. And not a single one of us is guaranteed another day. For all we know, tonight may be our night when our soul will be required of us. And then what is going to be the verdict? We're going to be weighed in the balances. And what is the judgment going to be? Are we going to hear the word, "Depart from me, you cursed"? Or are we going to hear our Father say, "Come, you blessed of my Father"? May God help us to have the strength and the courage we need to do whatever needs to be done. Don't let anything stand between you and making your life right with God. The grace, the gracious offer is there. The mercy of God has been extended to you. You have been given the opportunity to come and hear a message from His Word tonight. And how many other messages you've heard from His Word. Do what you need to do tonight. Don't walk away tonight and forget what you're hearing. And so, do you need to be baptized into Christ? Have you been washed of all of your sins? Do you need to repent? Do you need to come back to the Lord if you're a child of God? This could be your night. So if you need to respond to the Lord in any way, why don't you come as together we stand and sing.